Rao, star of so many anti-state house victories. And Mrs. James S. Pinkard of Montgomery, Alabama, the President General of the Southern League for the rejection of the Susan B. Anthony Amendment. Pearson made sure to emphasize Mrs. Pinkard's Southern bona fides. The blood of the old aristocratic South ran through her delicate veins. She was the grandniece of John C. Calhoun, who served his country as U.S. Senator from South Carolina, Vice President, and Secretary of State, and who promoted slavery as a positive good, rather than just a necessary evil. He developed the ideological foundations for states' rights and nullification upon which the Confederacy and Southern secession were based. Nina Pinkard kept her uncle's political concepts alive in her fight against ratification. It made Miss Pearson proud. Southern women defending Southern womanhood. She was almost giddy with delight. The idea that these important women, including several wives of Southern state governors, were coming to her own home, and she was their hostess. She couldn't pretend to be on their social level, but they shared an essential outlook, a basic bond. She was also pleased that this time around, it would be women leading the fight for the antis, not just men. From the beginning, Mr. Vertrees had instructed her how to use his arguments in her anti-suffrage messages. He would supply the idea and the bonework of the statements, but she should rewrite his communiques and put those frills and pleasantries on it which you ladies usually do. In the campaigns against state suffrage initiatives in 1917 and 1919, Mr. Vertrees had been adamant that no Tennessee anti-woman, not even Miss Pearson, the president, set foot in the state house to lobby legislators or testify. This time, the women were going to be out in front. Just as Southern women had bravely defended their homes and virtue during the War of Northern Aggression, Pearson was confident that they would now rally to defend Southern principles endangered by the amendment. Her pleas rang true with those white Southerners alarmed by the louder, bolder demands black people were making in 1920 as they chafed against the tightening grip of Jim Crow laws. Black men's service in the war and black women's work on the home front had emboldened their calls for equality, and white Southerners were reacting with alarm. Blacks were clamoring for better jobs and better pay, trying to push themselves into better houses and neighborhoods, agitating for improved schools and public facilities, organizing themselves into the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. In the eyes of many white Southerners, black citizens were getting too assertive. The revival of the Ku Klux Klan, it was experiencing a vigorous resurgence in Tennessee, as well as in the other Southern and border states, and a surge in lynchings were accepted by some as the most efficient way to teach black people to stay in their place. Of course, many blacks were leaving the South, following the train tracks north in the first waves of the Great Migration. The exodus had begun in 1916 as America prepared to enter the war, and factories in the north were hungry for workers. Now, even with the war over and white men demanding their jobs back, black families were steadily leaving the South, willing to brave the cold and the tenements for the promise of higher wages and the prospect of less demeaning segregation laws. But the recent arrival of tens of thousands of black Southerners to industrial cities, such as Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh, had inflamed racial tensions there and made Northerners nervous about this influx of black men able to vote and make policy decisions. It also made Northern politicians wary of increasing this black influence by giving black women the vote in their precincts. Somewhat ironically, this made Josephine Pearson's racist rationales for quashing the 19th Amendment, so carefully calibrated to Southern sensibilities, much more palatable and powerful in certain sections of the North. Pearson wasn't concerned with sympathetic Northerners. She concentrated on rousing her sister and brother Tennesseans. She'd already sent out a letter to sympathetic Tennessee women around the state, appealing for their active moral backing to fight the deadly principles embedded in the 19th Amendment, surrender of state sovereignty, Negro woman suffrage, and race equality. And she'd taken the lead with a mailing to every Tennessee anti, man and woman, urging them to insist that their state legislators uphold their oath of office and the honor of Tennessee by rejecting ratification. The fate of white civilization in the South may hang on a few votes either way, and your action may be the deciding influence with your representatives, Pearson wrote with her customary fondness for capital letter emphasis. So please let your neighbors and your representatives know where you stand in this great battle for state rights, honor, and the safety of Southern civilization. Chapter 11. The Woman's Hour. As soon as she arrived in Nashville, President General Nina Pinkard of the Southern Women's Rejection League sent her calling card to Carrie Catt. It took the form of an open letter, addressed to Catt, printed on the editorial page of the Chattanooga Times, and laced with a potent strain of political venom. "Southern women abhor political combat for their sex," Pinkard opened. "That is one of the reasons they deeply oppose the campaign of your organization to plunge women into perpetual political turmoil. We have no desire to make your campaign unpleasant," she continued, and then proceeded to make it as unpleasant as possible. "You are quoted in a morning newspaper as saying, 'There is nothing in the past quarter of a century that would be so indicative of the traditions of the Old South as would the ratification of this amendment,'" Pinkard wrote, referring to Catt's attempt to compliment the region's historic sense of honor. Mrs. Pinkard of Alabama was not accepting the compliment. "In view of this remarkable statement, I must ask you what your association meant when it passed a formal resolution printed in the Crisis, official Negro organ, that all American men or women, white or black, shall share equally in the privileges of democracy." Mrs. Pinkard was just warming up. "Again, what did you mean when, in a signed article in the same issue of that official organ, you wrote, 'Suffrage democracy knows no bias of race, color, creed, or sex'?" Such statements obviously had no place in the traditions of the Old or New South, Pinkard made quite clear. "In Tennessee, as you know," she continued, "ratification cannot be accomplished without the violation of legislators' solemn oath. Do you dare intimate, however indirectly, that the commission of perjury by public officers is indicative of the traditions of the Old South?" Mrs. Catt read on. "We intend to be as courteous to you as possible in any political campaign, but we must demand that the truth, whole truth, nothing but the truth, be stated in this matter of life or death to our beloved Southland." The Times framed Pinkard's letter with its own editorial commentary, warning that Catt was summoning a formidable lobby of Amazonian fighters to Tennessee who know the game. Catt finished Pinkard's diatribe. Pure bunkum was what she thought of it. But she would have to respond. She couldn't let it pass. She didn't mind the personal tone or the insinuations. She was accustomed to serving as the anti's punching bag. The oath matter was an anti-canard, but she knew it would need to be vigorously refuted. The mental vision of her very proper, well-corseted Suff matrons as spear-brandishing, one-bare-breasted Amazon warriors was deliciously ridiculous. But she always winced when that certain other issue made its debut. Anyone could have seen it coming. Catt knew the antis would play what in future political confrontations would be called the race card. She'd warned the Tennessee Suffs at the outset, before she'd even set foot in Nashville. The nigger question will be put forth in ways to arouse the greatest possible prejudice, she'd told them. Race had always been part of the picture. It bedeviled the suffrage movement, much as it haunted so many aspects of American social and political life. The two civil rights movements born as siblings out of abolitionism, one dedicated to achieving full equality for black citizens, the other for women, had a tense, ambivalent relationship. At the close of the Civil War, Elizabeth Stanton, Susan Anthony, Lucy Stone, and their fellow suffragists believed that universal suffrage, for black men and for all women, was just around the corner. In retrospect, they were naive in thinking that women's war work, in the Sanitary Commission, in the hospitals, in the Loyal League, would be rewarded with the franchise. Whether Abraham Lincoln would have ever supported a move as radical as giving women the ballot is doubtful, and became a moot question after his assassination. His successor, the Tennessee Democrat Andrew Johnson, who had been a slaveholder but remained loyal to the Union, certainly had no such inclinations. And the suffragists' Republican friends in Congress had more pressing problems after the war's end. Republican leaders complained that President Andrew Johnson was revealing his Southern sympathies with his lenient approach to reconstructing the rebellious states and pardoning their Confederate leaders, and this was undermining the spirit and letter of emancipation. Before the close of 1865, the Tennessee legislature was deliberating black codes to restrict the freedom and movement of the freed slaves, reducing the Negro to a kind of serfdom. Other southern states would soon follow with their own black codes. Violence against freed blacks was spreading, and in Tennessee, a new paramilitary group sprang up, composed of ex-Confederate soldiers who dressed in white robes and hoods, riding under the banner of the Ku Klux Klan. Spasms of white mob violence erupted in Memphis and New Orleans, with scores of black citizens killed. Alarmed by the deteriorating situation, abolitionists urged their Republican allies in Congress to do something to offer protective rights for the black population as quickly as possible, enforced on the federal level. Drafts of a new constitutional amendment, the 14th, began to circulate, one meant to secure equal protection, due process, and civil and voting rights to all persons. But not exactly all persons. For the very first time, in Section 2 of the proposed amendment, the part dealing with representation in Congress and penalties for infringing upon voting rights, the phrase male citizen appeared, where no such gender designation had ever before been made in the U.S. Constitution. The right of male citizens to vote. Elizabeth Stanton, Susan Anthony, and Lucy Stone screamed loudly in furious pronouncements to the press, in protest petitions to Congress, in biting letters to their abolitionist brothers, whom they felt, after so many years of toiling together, had betrayed them. And their allies did abandon them, for a combination of practical and political reasons. For the abolitionists, this was the historic moment consecrated in the blood of war for transforming slaves into citizens once and for all. Yes, Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison and Wendell Phillips agreed women should also get the vote, but the nation could not swallow two immense reforms at once, and the black man's very life depended upon his ability to protect himself with the vote. The terrible war between the states had not, after all, been waged for women's right to vote. This was the Negro's hour. The woman's hour would come, eventually, Douglass promised. But its time had not arrived. While Stanton and Anthony protested, Lucy Stone slowly acknowledged the political reality. If the wording could not be changed, better to adopt a flawed amendment to protect endangered black men's civil rights than nothing at all. But Stanton could not accept such a compromise. If that word male be inserted, it will take us at least a century to get it out, she moaned. I will cut off this right arm of mine before I will ever work for or demand the ballot for the Negro, and not for the woman, Susan Anthony declared. The old abolitionist coalition tried to hold together under the banner of the American Equal Rights Association, dedicated to securing suffrage and political rights for all Americans, irrespective of race, color, or sex. Frederick Douglass signed on as a vice president, and Garrison, Phillips, Stanton, Anthony, Mott, and Stone were all on the organization's masthead. But the alliance was a troubled one, riven by the question of whether manhood suffrage must take precedence over universal suffrage. To Stanton and Anthony, it was a false choice, and a tragic lost opportunity. This was the nation's hour, and a chance to perfect democracy. She urged women to press in through that constitutional door the moment it is opened for the admission of Sambo. The Negro male must not march to liberty over woman's prostrate form, Stanton and Anthony insisted.
It is with us a matter of life and death, Frederick Douglass shot back, and therefore cannot be postponed.
Women were not despised by society as black people were, said Douglass, framing the disparity in stark, heartbreaking terms.
When women, because they are women, are hunted down through the cities of New York and New Orleans, when they are dragged from their houses and hung upon lampposts, when their children are torn from their arms and their brains dashed out upon the pavement, when they are objects of insult and outrage at every turn, when they are in danger of having their homes burnt down over their heads, when their children are not allowed to enter schools, then they will have an urgency to obtain the ballot equal to our own.
Douglass was asked if this awful predicament was not also true for black women.
Yes, 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 it is true of the black woman, he replied, but not because she is a woman, but because she is black.
The Feminist Abolitionist Alliance continued to weaken as the 14th Amendment wended its way toward ratification in the states and disintegrated completely when the 15th Amendment was introduced in order to clarify and strengthen the voting rights provisions of the previous amendment. The right of citizens to vote cannot be denied or abridged on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Why not include one more word? Stanton asked. Why not just add the word sex to the protected status, and with those three letters, enfranchise all citizens? No, that was impossible, she was told. We should all walk through the door to the kingdom together, insisted Stanton and Anthony. And if women were not allowed to walk through that enchanted door to the franchise, they were prepared to block entry for the black man as well. They would fight against ratification of the 15th Amendment with a vengeance. Stanton and Anthony descended into depths of vile racist rhetoric, going so far as to warn against the horrible outrages against white women that were sure to follow the black man's enfranchisement and elevation in society. In a cynical ploy to appeal to southern states, which otherwise had little sympathy for woman suffrage, they argued that white woman's enfranchisement would provide an electoral bulwark against, quote, Negro rule in the South. In other states, they broadened their attack, vilifying the increasing number of immigrant men who were entitled to vote. Think of Patrick and Sambo and Hans and Young Tongue, Stanton snarled, who do not know the difference between a monarchy and a republic, never read the Declaration of Independence or Webster's spelling book, making decisions for educated and cultured white women. Lucy Stone was horrified by the pair's unhinged diatribes, and Wendell Phillips cut off financial support from abolition funds, isolating Stanton and Anthony from the movement and making them susceptible to a brief alliance with George Francis Train, an eccentric, flamboyant businessman with an appetite for unpopular causes and an unsavory reputation for unbridled racist sentiments. Lucy Stone called Train a raving lunatic and denounced her longtime colleagues. Stanton brushed off the criticism. If the devil steps forward ready to help, I shall say,
Good fellow, come on, she insisted.
In the end, the 15th Amendment was ratified, while the Abolition and Women's Rights Coalition Elizabeth and Susan had nurtured for the past 20 years was torn asunder. Stanton, Anthony, and their supporters formed the National Woman Suffrage Association, with the goal of advocating for a 16th Amendment providing the franchise to women, but also agitating for equal pay, an 8-hour workday, more equitable divorce laws, and other social reforms. Lucy Stone, together with her husband Henry Blackwell, Julia Ward Howe, and other more moderate feminists, formed the American Woman Suffrage Association, based in Boston, focusing on getting individual states to grant the vote to women, as states have authority over their own election laws, provided those laws agree with federal law, but steering clear of more radical issues. There was bad blood, both political and personal, between the two groups, and the split would not be healed for another quarter century. Meanwhile, the rift between Frederick Douglass and the woman suffragists, even Stanton and Anthony, was overcome more quickly. By 1873, the leaders of the suffrage movement began to make peace overtures to Douglass, and by 1876 he was once again an honored guest at their suffrage conventions. Stanton and Anthony welcomed him, realizing they needed Douglass's star power in their continuing campaign. Douglass was still a true believer in woman suffrage, and his magnanimous spirit allowed him to forgive, if not quite forget, the slurs suffragists had hurled at black men. He was still, quote, willing to be part of the bridge over which women should march to the full enjoyment of their rights, unquote. And Douglass was still proud of standing with Elizabeth Stanton in her demand for suffrage at Seneca Falls.
There are few facts in my humble history to which I look back with more satisfaction than that I was sufficiently enlightened at that early day, when only a few years from slavery, to support your resolution for woman suffrage, he told a women's convention in 1888. When I ran away from slavery, it was for myself. When I advocated emancipation, it was for my people. But when I stood up for the rights of women, self was out of the question, and I found a little nobility in the act.
The suffragists tended to be less noble. When the National held its first convention in a southern city, Atlanta, in 1895, Anthony personally asked Douglass to stay away, fearing his presence would antagonize white southern suffragists, whom the movement needed to attract and appease.
I did not want to subject him to humiliation, Anthony explained to a young black colleague, the civil rights activist Ida B. Wells, and I did not want anything to get in the way of bringing the southern white women into our suffrage association, now that their interest had been awakened.
Douglass realized his old friend was making a naked political calculation. She was protecting her cause at the expense of his. This type of accounting would be repeated many times in the future. Despite the difficulties the Suffs faced in their quest for equality, upending centuries of law and millennia of cultural tradition, all these paled in comparison with the challenges black citizens faced in securing their basic rights. It would always be safer and easier for the women to lay their claim, precisely because they were the close kin of the men in power. They were not other or alien. They were the wives and mothers, sisters and daughters of the men of the white ruling class. They might not have the vote, but they had familial ties, social standing, and elite educations and connections. Most important, unlike the black man and woman petitioning for fundamental dignity and rights, the Suffs were not despised for their skin color or dismissed as lesser beings. They did not bear the perpetual scars of slavery. Nevertheless, Frederick Douglass remained a steadfast woman's rights man until the day he died in February 1895, just 2 weeks after that Atlanta convention, and just hours after participating in another women's rights convention in Washington, D.C. When Susan Anthony received the news of his death, she rushed from the convention to Douglass's home in Anacostia, across the Potomac River from Washington, to console Douglass's widow. She sat grieving with Helen Douglas for the next days, helping to arrange the funeral services, staying in the guest bedroom the Douglases reserved for her visit. Her framed portrait hung above the hearth. In Douglas's own study, a large oil portrait of Elizabeth Stanton had pride of place on the wall, adjacent to a painting of Abraham Lincoln. Anthony eulogized her friend at the Washington ceremonies, with senators, congressmen, and Supreme Court judges in the pews of Metropolitan AME Church, while thousands of mourners thronged the surrounding streets. The son of Douglas's last slave master sent a floral tribute. Reverend Dr. Anna Howard Shaw, who along with Carrie Catt was one of Aunt Susan's girls, used her preaching gifts to offer a stirring benediction. And Anthony read a tribute from Elizabeth Stanton, too infirm to attend, expressing her grief at Douglas's passing and her appreciation of his sustaining moral power. Frederick Douglass is not dead. His grand character will long be an object lesson in our national history. His lofty sentiments of liberty, justice, and equality, echoed on every platform over our broad land, must influence and inspire many coming generations. Carrie Catt was in that next generation, and when she read the press accounts of Douglas's funeral, the accolades offered by Anthony, Stanton, and Shaw, she was dismayed. "The relation of our leaders to the colored question at the Douglas funeral has completely taken the wind out of our sails," Catt complained to a fellow self. "You should see some of the clippings I have from the Southern press and some of the letters. They were a little suspicious of us all along, but now they know we are abolitionists in disguise, with no other thought than to set the Negro in dominance over them." Carrie Catt had already become a suffrage politician. Over the following decades, as Catt became the movement's preeminent politician, she was forced to grapple with the race issue again and again. Voting rights and race were inexorably bound together, as they would be for the rest of the 20th century, as they continue to be now. It seemed to come down to a cruel, damnable choice, as if one group of citizens needed to win and another must lose at each step of progress. There was no entering into the gates of the kingdom together. When forced to choose between truly equal rights and women's rights, between insisting on justice for all or accepting injustice to protect their own cause, the suffs almost invariably chose the easier, less noble path. In 1903, when racist Southern suffragists steered the National Association toward a Southern strategy, allowing each state association to handle the suffrage issue in harmony with its local customs, which in the South meant winning the vote for white women but not black, and ignoring the federal amendment, Catt, in her first term as president, acquiesced. She also tolerated the use of a jaundiced rationale. To assuage the fears of Southern legislators in Congress and in state houses, suffragists often made the argument that giving the vote to women would not threaten white supremacy, but actually amplify it. It was a matter of simple mathematics. There were more white women in the Southern states than black women and men combined, even if blacks were actually allowed to vote, and more native-born women than immigrants in the northern cities. She allowed census statistics to be brandished as proof in hearing testimony, even in the pages of The Woman Citizen. White hegemony was safe. Alice Paul made similar cynical calculations. When Ida B. Wells, the fearless black journalist and activist who chronicled the epidemic of lynchings of black men, and was forced to flee Memphis when her office was firebombed and her life threatened, wanted to join Alice Paul's suffrage march in Washington in March 1913, she hit the wall of convenient suffrage racism. Wells understood how essential it was for black women to gain the ballot to protect their families, and she founded Chicago's Alpha Suffrage Club, the city's first club for black women devoted to suffrage. But Paul refused to allow her to march with the delegation of Illinois suffragists, as an integrated contingent might upset white Southern participants. Wells was told to march at the back of the parade with the black suffs. She would not be intimidated, and refused to march at the rear. As the Illinois contingent passed by, Will stepped from the sidewalk into the procession, defiantly marching shoulder to shoulder with her white comrades. Both Paul and Kat recognized that the federal amendment needed the support of white, southern, conservative women if suffrage ever hoped to make inroads in the region, and needed the votes of similarly inclined southern men if it was to ever succeed in Congress and in the state houses for ratification. They tried to avoid antagonizing southerners with talk of full equal rights, black and white. Negro men cannot vote in South Carolina, and therefore Negro women could not if women were to vote in the nation, Alice Paul told a reporter in early 1919 to ease the federal amendment fears of southerners. We are organizing white women in the South. When the NAACP asked Paul's Woman's Party to repudiate such statements, it refused. Black suffragists such as Wells, NAACP co-founder Mary Church Terrell, who considered Kat a personal friend and insisted she was completely free of race prejudice, and W.E.B. Du Bois of the NAACP, had every reason to be skeptical of, and at times dismayed by, the equivocations of white suffragists who spoke of justice, but more often acted in their own self-interest. Dr. Du Bois was a steadfast universal suffragist in the mold of Douglas, and while he spoke at many suffrage conventions and dedicated many pages in the NAACP's journal, The Crisis, to the topic of woman suffrage, for all women, he did not flinch from calling out Anna Shaw and Carrie Catt and Alice Paul for their lapses into hypocrisy. Catt deliberately put on blinders as needed. Though she was an unabashed dry, she distanced herself, and the National Association, from any official ties to the temperance movement and its apotheosis, prohibition, as the historically close links between the two movements had created too many enemies for suffrage. Kat refused to endorse Margaret Sanger's birth control league, though Sanger frequently and ardently asked for her support. Kat appreciated how important women's control of their bodies could be in achieving full social and economic freedom, but alliance with what was still an illegal enterprise, distributing contraceptives and providing abortions, was just too dangerous for the National Association. She was also enough of a Victorian to find the public discussion of sexual matters distasteful. When it came to war and peace, she made what was for her the most painful compromise, aligning herself and the National behind the war machine for political advantage. Personally, Kat was offended by Jim Crow segregation and appalled by lynchings. But even after the war, after black men had proven themselves in the military and black women distinguished themselves on the home front, Kat resisted the request of a consortium of black women's clubs to become cooperative members of the National, knowing that the group intended to force the National Association to take a stand on African American women's voting rights. This was in the winter of 1919, when the U.S. Senate was still stalling on the federal amendment, several southern senators still digging in their heels. Kat feared the repercussions if the National welcomed the black suffrage clubs. She asked them to withdraw their application for membership until the federal amendment was law, until suffrage for white women was safe. So it was in keeping with Kat's willingness to make morally suspect compromise and capitulation that she determined Mrs. Pinkard's public accusations could not be allowed to go unanswered. Not in Nashville. Not at this critical juncture. She called in her stenographer. You ask if I will amplify my meaning when I wrote, "Suffrage democracy knows no bias of race, color, creed, or sex," she dictated, as the stenographer penciled curly symbols on a pad of paper. I do not know that I ever wrote it, or in what context it stood if I did. Through her hotel window, Kat could see the state capitol, just two blocks away. The state house was built of huge blocks of local gray Bigsby limestone and enormous columns of East Tennessee marble that had been quarried and cut, transported and hauled in the 1840s and 1850s by prisoners and black slaves, under the supervision of stonemasons and the occasional overseer's whip. It was a handsome building, at once imposing and delicate, graced with a tall cupola topped by a decorative finial. The Capitol building had been the despised Yankee headquarters through 3 years of Union occupation during the Civil War, fortified by a circle of cannons aimed at the restive city below. It was ironic that the woman's hour might finally toll inside a building built by the sweat of slaves, occupied by Mr. Lincoln's troops, where the marble railings were still pocked with bullet holes from the gunfight that erupted when the Tennessee legislature argued over the ratification of the 14th Amendment, state sovereignty, and the rights of citizens to vote. Chapter 12. Cranking the Machine.
"I have come to help you win the 36th state," Carrie Cat announced to her Tennessee troops, with the crisp inflection of a command. Under the circumstances, it was a supremely optimistic notion, but Cat always liked to view her glass as half full. She'd learned it was the only sane way to approach the seemingly impossible. Everything the cause had accomplished, every state won, every piece of legislation, every change of heart and shift in policy, was once considered utterly impossible. Until it wasn't. The trick was to create a positive atmosphere, she believed. Conjure your own climate of success, set an ambitious goal, and then build your own highway to reach it. "Roll up your sleeves, set your mind to making history, and wage such a fight for liberty that the whole world will respect our sex," she'd exhorted again and again. Make success seem natural, inexorable, she always told her suffrage workers. People, especially men, especially politicians, like to be on the winning side. So hers was the winning plan, not just the workable plan. The victory convention, not simply the 1920 convention. Some called this premature boasting, others viewed it as hubris, but Cat considered it straightforward optimism. Optimism plus a plan, always a detailed plan, augmented by elbow grease, would yield results. Now was that time to crank her political pressure machine, a multi-tiered engine designed to exert force downward from the White House, the presidential candidates, and national parties, and upward from the people of Tennessee, all energies focused on squeezing the governor and men of the State House. She'd begun the action at the top, with Woodrow Wilson, Cox, and Harding. Now she'd start the agitation from below and engage essential gears in the middle. The chief took command and issued her first set of marching orders to the Tennessee League of Women Voters, sending them out into the field. Mrs. Kenney's poll of the legislature had too many gaps. Too many legislators had not responded or refused to reveal their inclinations. "That unheard-from number can and may defeat the ratification," she told the League women, who were all veterans of the National Association. Those secretive Solons needed to be tracked down and pinned down. "Go find them. Go knock on their doors," she ordered. "Gather a group of local women to visit each legislator," Cat instructed. "The larger the deputation, the more impressed the delegate will be, and demand he sign the pledge to support ratification. Be prepared to confront negative responses. The antis were already busy. They were on the ground trying to convince legislators to pledge against ratification," Cat warned her tender troopers. "They will lie, misrepresent, and appeal to all the sordid motives they may find. Please hasten now and report as fast as you can," she implored. "We must trust in God, but keep our powder dry." Even the devoted pacifist had taken up military lingo. State suffrage leaders Kate Warner and Abby Milton had finally returned from their travels, and Cat summoned them, as well as Catherine Kenny, to her room for briefings. They agreed that Tennessee's friends of suffrage needed to be shaken awake from their summer stupor with a series of revival meetings across the state, starring the chief. And Cat also needed to speak to the men, to the commercial civic elite, that crucial middle layer of political influence. Abby Milton offered to escort Cat on the trip. Marjorie would join them.
Those events were being arranged, and while Kat knew it was the absolute best way to spark enthusiasm and garner publicity, she wasn't looking forward to 10 days on the road in this roasting heat. Too many legislators were holding back, as if they were waiting for orders or blandishments before committing. The pledges already in hand were being carefully card indexed by Catherine Kenney and her league workers, using the National's proven system. At New York headquarters, file cabinets bulged with folders for every congressman and senator. They'd been compiled at Suffrage House in Washington over the years, as well as governors and key state legislators, detailing their political and personal lives. The cards recorded his background, character, and temperament, data on his political, business, social, and religious affiliations, a record of his votes and stands on woman suffrage and other public issues. There was also a confidential memo on any known scandals or indiscretions in his closet, his friends and enemies, his vulnerable spots. The Woman's Party maintained an even more detailed dossier system at their headquarters. The antis railed against the indexing system, claiming it was, variously, an invasion of privacy, a diabolical blackmailing scheme, or, given its efficiency, an un-American tool inspired by Germany. Kat took their denunciations as proof that the system worked. Esther Ogden arrived in Nashville, hand-delivering Governor Cox's message of support to Kat. Ogden was a shrewd, detail-oriented suff whom Kat had put in charge of the Woman Suffrage Publishing Company, which pumped out tens of thousands of pieces of informational literature a year, including the ever-changing versions of the suffrage map, published The Woman Citizen, and was readying the final volumes of The History of Woman Suffrage. Now Ogden offered Kat an unvarnished report from the temporary center of the political universe, Ohio. Cox was earnest, Ogden assured Kat. Whether he could be effective was a different question. Carrie Kat believed that evolution drives an upward arc. In her own lifetime, she'd witnessed the progress of societal attitudes toward woman suffrage, the large cultural shifts that provided an opening for distinct victories, the accumulation of those small victories making change seem more natural. Aunt Susan used to say that she could sense those shifts, mark suffrage's social and political progress, by what types of objects were thrown at her when she spoke on a stage or soapbox. The rotten eggs of the early days evolved into simply raw eggs, a big improvement. The rotten tomatoes transformed into more benign vegetal projectiles. The verbal assaults grew less vulgar, the physical threats less ominous. And then there was Aunt Susan's favorite liminal moment, when Buffalo Bill Cody saluted her, and, by extension, the cause, on horseback at his Wild West show. It was at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, where a grand woman's building showcased the accomplishments of women around the globe, and the World's Congress of Representative Women of All Lands brought together 500 delegates from 27 countries to discuss a wide range of topics. Suffrage was definitely on the agenda. The week-long Congress drew almost 150,000 spectators, and Anthony and Stanton gave speeches to very large, enthusiastic audiences. "We did a whizzing business," Kat noted with pleasure, as the suffs handed out reams of literature. Anthony was so fascinated by the magnificent white city, and so delighted by public response to suffrage talks, that she stayed the whole summer. She gave more speeches, but just her presence on the grounds was a walking advertisement for the cause. Her face had become the personification of the movement. Crowds gathered around and cheered her on the pathways. Audiences applauded her. Even if she wasn't speaking, they wanted her to stand up and take a bow. She was a celebrity. After so many years of ridicule and rebuke, she enjoyed it mightily. And the ideas of woman suffrage seemed to have emerged from the realm of freakish and frightening into popular conversation. Buffalo Bill's show, starring that amazing lady sharpshooter Annie Oakley, was the entertainment hit of the fair, and Cody invited Anthony to be his guest in a ringside box. Cody made his entrance astride his horse, racing full tilt around the sawdust arena, waving his hat as the band played. he galloped straight for Anthony, wearing her trademark red silk shawl, clapping in the front row. He pulled up the reins, whipped off his cowboy hat, and gave her a grand salute. The crowd cheered and gave her an ovation. She stood, bowed, and waved her handkerchief in thanks. It was one of those moments when Anthony felt that things changed. Attitudes shifted. It wasn't just the respect and affection shown to her at the Wild West show. It was the audiences at the fair, the way they listened respectfully and didn't jeer. It was the way the press suddenly treated her differently. Kat noticed the change, too. The cartoonists had pictured Miss Anthony for years, with a dress hanging in uneven scallops and carrying a large umbrella, she explained. Other suffragists were made to look like escapers from the insane asylums. Anti-suffragists were good-looking, fashionably dressed, highly respectable women. Now the cartoonists changed their clothes. Miss Anthony never carried her umbrella in a cartoon after 1893. Failure is impossible, was Anthony's parting exhortation to her followers, and Carrie Cat accepted this as not simply an upbeat motto, but a working philosophy. There would be many failures, but failures must be transformed into valuable lessons. From the time of their first bitter referendum defeat in Kansas in 1867, to this moment in Nashville in 1920, the suffragists undertook 480 petition and lobbying drives to get state legislatures to submit suffrage amendments to voters, 277 campaigns to get state party conventions to include woman suffrage planks in their platforms, and 56 state referendum campaigns trying to convince male voters to grant them the vote. Most of these campaigns were unsuccessful, and 19 sessions of Congress rebuffed their efforts for a federal amendment. But always, the Suffs tried again. When Kat lost the first suffrage referendum in New York in 1915, after orchestrating 10,300 rallies, distributing 7.5 million leaflets, parading down Fifth Avenue with 40,000 marchers before more than a million spectators, she and Molly watched the returns from headquarters, saw the tears in the eyes of their faithful workers. "How long will it delay your fight, Carrie?" Anna Shaw had asked her that night. "Only until we can get a little sleep. Our campaign will be on again tomorrow morning," Kat replied. Suffrage had not been defeated, she insisted, only postponed. They learned from their mistakes and tried again. Victory in 17 was their new motto. On election night 1917, Carrie and Molly watched as the building that housed the New York Times, whose editorial pages opposed suffrage with every pica inch of type it could muster, flashed its rooftop white spotlight to signal that the referendum had passed. New York women had won the vote. It was another of those moments when Kat could feel the shift, in both popular opinion and political consequence. Winning New York, the nation's most populous state, caught the attention of every politician, from President Wilson on down, and turned the tide for the federal amendment. If things looked iffy in Tennessee, Kat would never admit it in public. She would be resolutely, defiantly optimistic. Hope was a powerful motivational tool. But privately, she was worried. All around Tennessee, suffragists were roaming the countryside, hunting down the legislators who'd not yet responded, many of whom lived in remote areas of the state. Some deputations traveled by train to tiny depots to find the village home of their delegates. Others were carried in wagons as far as the road would go, finishing the journey to an isolated farmstead on foot, their dresses trailing in the dust or mud. Still others set off on the state's rutted mountain roads to confront their reluctant representatives. They were drenched by rainstorms, chased by watchdogs, and stranded by flat tires, but they found their men. On the second floor of the Commercial Club of Nashville, in the handsomely draped dining room, the Kiwanis Club held its luncheon meetings, and the guest speaker at this hastily called special event on Friday, July 23rd, was Mrs. Kat. She entered the inner sanctum of Nashville's business world with the brisk air of an experienced executive. This was her debut public performance in the Tennessee campaign, and she needed to make a strong impression. The Kiwanis Club men were the friends and colleagues, partners and clients, fishing buddies and poker chums of the men who made decisions in this town and in the State House. She had to convince them that it was in their interest to support ratification of the federal amendment. It was the perfect place to try out her approach, the lines of logic, the persuasive arguments, the bits of color she'd use on the stump around Tennessee. Her primary goal was to refute the contention, being circulated by the antis, that any legislator who voted for ratification would be abrogating the state constitution and violating his oath of office to protect that constitution, no matter what the U.S. Supreme Court ruled. She needed to smash that specious argument with the solid hammer of legal reasoning before it became accepted as fact. Earlier in the week, the Tennessee Bar Association muddied the waters by deciding that they would not recommend that the governor include ratification of the federal amendment in his agenda for the special session, as they thought that a ratification vote would be of questionable legality. Kat fumed. Can't they read the law? She'd telephoned the National's legal counsel, former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Charles Evans Hughes, in despair. He chuckled. Most lawyers don't know how to read the U.S. Constitution, he told her. Sometimes it was convenient to be ignorant. After a flattering introduction, Kat rose to take the lectern. It was an hour past noon, and the thermometer had already passed the 90-degree mark. The ceiling fan paddles spun fast, making a low whirring sound, circulating the sweet, musky scent of tobacco smoke around the room. Reporters from the Tennessean and the Banner opened their notebooks and poised their pens. Seated at a table in the audience, Major Edward Bushrod Stallman, publisher of the Banner, turned in his chair to listen. Stallman had limped into the dining room to take his seat, announcing his arrival with the thump of his ornate walking stick. He was a true self-made man. He'd arrived as a 10-year-old immigrant boy from Germany, begun work as a cart driver for the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, and made his way up to vice president of the Louisville and Nashville Railroad, and then to commissioner of the Southern Railway and Steamship Association. Railroads built the city of Nashville, and he was a railroad man. He became a highly persuasive lobbyist for LNN interests in state houses around the South. Some hinted that his persuasive powers were enhanced by an open wallet. When the LNN was threatened by unfavorable legislation in the Tennessee General Assembly, Stallman bought a newspaper to serve as a platform for pro-industry opinions. He pumped new life into the Nashville Banner, and it prospered as he enjoyed broadening the paper's political opinions and his own clout. He left the railroad to become a full-time publisher and helped to establish the Associated Press News Syndicate. He was still a good friend of the LNN, and railroad interests continued to wield clout in the halls of the Tennessee legislature. Though he'd never served in the military, Major was just an honorific, Stallman was a proud American, despite what his enemies said, and a dedicated Nashville citizen. He served a term as an alderman, took a seat on the Tennessee State Board of Education, cared about his adopted city. He was a man who valued loyalty. He was loyal to his friends and employees and equally devoted to crushing his enemies. He didn't mind having enemies. All important men made enemies. It was a mark of power. He counted mayors, governors, and senators among those who did not like him or did not like his newspaper, which was one and the same. He was the Banner. He could make or break a Tennessee candidate or cause with his little finger. His feud with Luke Lee began years ago as a friendly rivalry between competing newspapers. But when the Tennessean took to attacking the railroads, especially the LNN, claiming they, together with the liquor industry, owned the legislature and effectively ran the state, a sharp edge entered the relationship. Then Lee carried this crusade with him to Washington, where he initiated Senate hearings to investigate the railroad trusts, with the aim of regulating them more stringently. Stallman used the Banner to lash back at Lee, and used his political leverage to help oust Lee from his Senate seat. For the first time, Thanks to the 17th Amendment, the people would elect their U.S. senators in the 1914 elections, and Stallman backed a congressman from Memphis, Kenneth McKellar, to run against Lee in the Democratic primary. McKellar won. Lee was booted out. And then the feud turned ugly. Stallman was an unapologetic, wet man, which put him on another collision course with the ultra-dry Lee over prohibition laws. Stallman also refused to jump on the war bandwagon and used the Banner's editorial pages to argue against entry into the European conflict. For this, he paid a terrible price. The Tennessean launched a witch hunt against Stallman, calling him a Hun by birth, a Hun at heart, a Hun with all his evil and devilish characteristics. Lee used his Washington contacts to spur a Justice Department investigation of Stallman's citizenship and loyalty, while the Tennessean beat the drum for Stallman to be classified as an enemy alien under the Wilson administration's draconian alien, sedition, and espionage laws, punishing anyone who disparaged or even questioned the war. Stallman defended himself by switching the Banner's editorial page toward supporting America in the war, and he became a leader in selling Liberty War Bonds. Meanwhile, the Tennessean continued to publish editorial cartoons portraying Stallman in a German uniform. The war was over now, but Stallman could neither forget nor forgive Lee for this vicious vendetta, and the Banner's editorial pages reflected the continuing animosity. The publishers were at loggerheads about the gubernatorial primary at the moment, Stallman supporting Roberts and Lee working against him, though they were stiffly aligned, at least on paper, in the Men's Ratification Committee. The political was always personal for Edward Stallman. The feud lived on. At the lectern, Carrie Catt didn't pussyfoot around. She launched right into her main themes, in terms the Kiwanians could readily understand. It would be bad for Tennessee's business image and Nashville's future to delay or deny ratification of the amendment. Moreover, it would be downright embarrassing. Tennessee will be made ridiculous in the eyes of all citizens of this country who know the U.S. Constitution if she refuses to ratify on the grounds of unconstitutionality, Catt told them flatly. The Supreme Court had spoken decisively, she insisted, and the Tennessee Constitution's prohibitions on a sitting legislature voting on ratification of a federal amendment had been ruled null and void. She tackled headlong the rumors about legislators violating their oath of office by voting on ratification. Every legislator takes an oath of loyalty to both the state and the federal constitutions, she reminded her audience. And the federal constitution takes precedence, as it is the supreme law of the land. Always the school teacher, Catt urged everyone to go to a bookstore, buy a copy of the U.S. Constitution, and read Article 6, Sections 2 and 3 on the Oath of Office, so they could approach a wavering legislator on the issue and set him right. Having dispatched the legal arguments, she moved on to the political. Both major political parties and both presidential candidates were urging ratification. Not urging it quite strongly enough, she thought, but did not let that slip from her lips. And it would not be wise for Tennessee to disappoint. There were many ways the state could be punished. She didn't have to elaborate on that. Everyone in the room understood. She ended on an emotional, patriotic note. We have just emerged from the greatest war known, which was fought for liberty and democracy, she told the Kiwanians. And more than 100,000 American men gave their lives in service to that cause. Democracy was ascendant in Europe, and European women, even German and Russian women, were voting. Where was democracy for American women? She asked incredulously, making suffrage a matter of national pride. In closing, she made a rousing exhortation for Tennessee to come forward and take its place within the glorious movement toward world democracy. There was loud applause. Major Stallman approached Mrs. Catt and the suffragists surrounding her after her speech, his cane rapping toward them. Even at 77 years, he was a powerful presence, with strong features, a head of snowy hair, and an energy, perhaps best described as barely contained ferocity, that expressed itself in an